So it's Monday, and I'm getting ready for some football. Unfortunately, try as I might, I cannot stop thinking about Brett Favre and this craziness about these text messages that he allegedly sent to a young lady who worked as a game day hostess for his former team, the New York Jets. You know, the ones that included pictures of his boy parts on full, and I mean full display. The kinds of text messages that make us married folks say to ourselves, if this is what passes for courting these days, I am really glad I got married before this kind of nonsense. Can I just tell you, I recognize the manner in which this story came out is particularly sleazy, even by today's so-called standards. And I further recognize that with 1 in 10 Americans officially out of work, many people have much more important things to think about than a multimillion-dollar athlete and his alleged boorish antics. But I can't help it. I'm still thinking about this story because it is in part a story of what goes on at work, and it is in part a story about the kinds of things that continue to make it difficult for half the population to succeed at work. Now, I can practically hear the collective eye rolling by some of you out there. Now, maybe it's hard to think of sexual harassment as a scenario in a job where people take their portraits wearing outfits that barely cover their girl parts. But professional football is, after all, a job in which men are expected to be adult enough and professional enough to take questions after a game while wrapped in a towel in the locker room. And while I don't know exactly what a game day hostess does, if the unspoken job description requires getting intimate with players, I think the authorities a little higher up the food chain than the sports columnists will be very interested to hear about that, because there's a name for that job, and it isn't game day hostess. Now, to be fair, I think we should all be adults and recognize that some people do socialize at work. For some people, that's part of why they work, where they work, for the opportunity to be a part of the scene. And if you want to call it trying to get an MRS, or at the very least some approximation of it, I won't start a fist fight. But when I consider all the male executives who are married to people whom they met at work, and I assume these relationships are of their own free will, I have to assume that the instinct or desire to find companionship at work applies to both genders. And frankly, I don't know that that is so horrible as long as people who are doing the socializing are giving full value for whatever work they do perform, and as long as people are really free not to get intimately involved with people at work. But herein lies the problem. What about the people who just want to go to work, or the people who don't want to socialize with a particular colleague or boss? It seems far too often the people on the losing end of this equation are women, because despite the growing numbers of women with PhDs and six-figure salaries, the rules of the workplace are still written by and for men. For example, it's my understanding that many of the professional football teams consider it a firing offense for cheerleaders or dancers to socialize with players. Now, it's a firing offense for the cheerleaders or dancers, that is. And as has been reported by the gossip site that first published the pictures, the young lady in question resisted Brett Favre's advances, saying she did not want to end up in the garbage can. You can see her point. Is there anybody who can honestly envision a scenario where a star player loses his job because of some unpleasantness with a female employee? Not going to happen. Now, on the plus side, the league and sports writers seem to be taking this and other allegations of bad behavior toward women seriously. A decade ago, I doubt that would have been the case. The fact is, though, that too many grown men seem to think that women at the workplace exist for their enjoyment. And that tells you everything you need to know about how far there is yet to go. Coming up, Tommy Smith and John Carlos made history in the 1968 Olympics, not just by winning gold and bronze medals, but by lowering their heads and raising their fists in a Black Power salute. John Carlos explains what happened next.
You know, it was a tremendous amount of people proud and had admiration and love for what we did. And then they had other people that was disenchanted and hated what we did.
Now Tommy Smith says he wants to sell his medal. John Carlos tells us how he feels about that. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Here's a side effect of the First Amendment, which guarantees free speech. You don't need any qualifications whatsoever to work in the media. Journalism schools, as a result, are often asked to justify their very existence. How can they charge tens of thousands of dollars per year to train students for a collapsing industry that doesn't even require a degree? NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik took a trip to one leading campus and found surprisingly little despair.
Are USC's all-British improv troupe?
We wear
tights and frilly shirts.
It's a brilliant day, as so many are at the University of Southern California, an oasis smack in the middle of Los Angeles. campus clubs and academic programs make their pitch.
You don't have to be Indian to join.
Yeah, you don't have to be Indian to join. Learn about objectivism. Who's interested in philosophy?
Wait, college is a time of exploration and reinvention, but freshman Orion DeNevers readily volunteers what he won't be studying.
I would be a journalism major if it had any future.
DeNevers is standing inside a lecture hall at USC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, a dynamic school with renowned innovators and Pulitzer Prize winners on the faculty. We're talking during a break in an introduction to journalism course, but DeNevers says he'll major in something else.
I mean, information, I think we'll just all be basically free, and so there's going to be no money to be made in journalism. And as much as I would, like, pursue my love and all of that, I like food too, and I don't know, I just don't want to sacrifice it all.
A lot of big papers are owned by bankrupt companies, including the Los Angeles Times. ABC News just let go of a quarter of its entire staff. And Newsweek and Business Week magazines were in such tough shape, they were sold for a dollar apiece. At USC, undergraduate tuition and fees are around $47,000 a year. So back at that intro class, the school's former dean, Jeffrey Cowan, wanted to hear why students were there. Freshman Aaron Liu wrote for his high school paper about teacher layoffs there.
Slowly as I was, like, writing that story and I was, like, discovering more and more about the implications of those budget cuts, you know, these are people with, like, children to feed, these are people, you know, who have bills to pay. And slowly I kind of realized the power of journalism and being able to, like, enlighten people.
How did your parents feel?
Initially, my parents were really skeptical. And I guess it's not just my parents, it's, like, my whole community. Like, every time I said I was a journalism major, they'd be like, oh, do you know that's a dying profession? I'm like, oh, yeah, you're, like, the 50th person to say that or something like that.
Liu is one of 550 journalism students at Annenberg, many of whom get significant financial aid from the university. Veteran newspaper editor Geneva Overholzer is director of journalism at Annenberg. She says the school still trains students in traditional news values, but gives them the tools to figure out how to apply them to a very different age.
It's a renaissance. It's a recreation. It's a very scary time. I don't mean to sound blithe about this. It's unsettling, but it's exceedingly promising. And these students know that they're going to recreate it.
Callie Schweitzer is a 21-year-old senior from Westchester, New York. She's already had internships at People Magazine and the New York Times.
I don't believe it when people say journalism is dead. I'm always that person raising their hand and going, no, it's not. I think it will always exist.
Schweitzer used to write for the independent student paper The Daily Trojan. Now she's the editor-in-chief of Neon Tommy, the school's 24-hour online news site.
We need reliable journalists who are trustworthy and who are credible that we can follow and understand. And I look at things like Twitter and people who build followings, and it's because they're reputable.
Neon Tommy has broken enough stories about L.A. that the dean of Annenberg, Ernest Wilson, says he's both a little bit weary of taking calls from angry donors and politicians and quite proud his students' stories are having such an impact.
If you look around the world, whether it's a developing country or a developed country, rich or poor, if that country has a free and independent press, then it's much more likely they're going to be a democracy. And I think that those of us in the journalism education field have an obligation to help train people who can provide information in the public interest.
Some of that information in the public interest may take unconventional forms, like giving flip cameras and cell phones to migrant workers so they can post blog entries about their own lives. Robert Hernandez is a young professor who used to be a multimedia editor at several big newspapers.
We've been journalistically kind of in crisis for more than 5 years. And these students have signed up to come to J School knowing that that's the environment they're facing. And they're not thinking, doom and gloom, but there's something exciting happening in our industry. It's happening in our classroom, it's happening in our newsroom, and these folks want to be a part of it.
Hernandez and his colleagues don't promise students they'll earn the high-paying salaries of network anchors, or that they'll become anchors, or that there will be networks. They promise them the chance to help define the news for years to come. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
Now, the school just received one big vote of support. On Friday, the Annenberg Family Foundation gave it another $50 million, this time to help pay for a new building with cutting-edge media facilities.
And in the wine business, everything old is new again. For example, a growing number of restaurants and wine bars are now serving wine on tap, just like beer. And if you didn't know that was an old way of doing it, it is a return to traditions from Europe and from America just after Prohibition. As Cy Musiker of member station KQED reports, it's part of a green evolution in the wine business.
Gus Volkamp is wine director for Out the Door.
a mini chain of Asian fusion restaurants in San Francisco. He serves plenty of wine by the bottle, but also four wines drawn from taps behind the bar. And here's why.
Number one, it's better to reuse than recycle. I think our recycling's probably been decreased by at least half.
So it's greener for the restaurant. The wine, about two cases worth per keg, stays fresh for weeks because the tanks are pressurized with inert gases. And keg wine is cheaper.
Because the producers aren't adding on the cost of the bottle, the label, the cork, the carton, and the transportation it comes in. I mean, I'm able to buy these wines at 25% from the wholesale bottle cost. The producer can increase his markup and still make money. I can offer it to the consumer at a discount and still make money. I mean, everyone wins on it.
So this is your traditional 5.2-gallon soda keg. It has a little ball valve in here, and you can see they still have nitrogen in it.
We're about 80 miles due north of San Francisco now, in the cellars of Preston of Dry Creek, a small winery that was one of the first to sell its wine in kegs. Matt Norelli is the winemaker.
It's a nod to the farming traditions of the past in Dry Creek Valley, and also a little bit of a nod to the same system they have in place all throughout Europe, where they have little communes, and you can go and you can get your jug of wine from your local appellation and bring it back to your house, and you're all set for your everyday table wine.
Many of Preston's bottlings are meant for long aging, but Norelli whips up blends of less tannic, less oaky wines just for the keg wine market.
You know, it takes a little bit of the snob appeal out of it. It makes it more of a food, which is what it should be. It makes it for people just to have it with their dinner, and that's what we want.
A few miles south of Preston, Hardy Wallace handles sales for NPA Winery, the Natural Process Alliance, which takes the eco concept up another notch.
A lot of people talk about the romantic sounds of, you know, popping a cork and, you know, that. But what's more exciting and more romantic than steel on steel, baby? That's a good sound.
NPA sells its wines only in kegs and 3/4-liter steel canteens, and only within a 100-mile radius. Wallace makes the restaurant deliveries like a dairyman from America's past.
Every week I load up milk crates of wine, and I drop off crates of wine to them. I pick up their empties, take them back to be sterilized, and the goal is to have zero waste in packaging.
That's the sound of a standard bottling line at work at Ballantine Winery in Napa Valley. It's a vivid demonstration of the packaging, corks, labels, bottles, and boxes that this keg wine trend avoids. In another corner of the winery, Michael Willett rents space to run his burgeoning keg wine empire, selling wine from Ballantine and a dozen more of Napa's top estates. One reason his business is taking off, he says, the wine industry is just coming out of a historic recession.
There's a surplus of quality inventory. And because of that, wineries are opening their marketing strategy to other formats. But once they start it and see how smart it is and how green it is, they're embracing the concept.
Sales of keg wine are growing, but it's still a niche market too small to measure. The biggest limitation, the hassle factor. Custom-made kegs still have to be cleaned and filled by hand, and no one's yet worked out a system to automate the process or do it on a large scale. For NPR News, I'm Cy Musiker.
As we've been hearing, some of the nation's largest home lenders are being sued for allegedly filing fraudulent foreclosure documents. Banks are now delaying foreclosures, and some lawmakers want to temporarily halt all foreclosures. NPR's Chris Arnold tells us what this could mean for homeowners in financial trouble, as well as the larger economy.
Around the country, homeowners on the verge of foreclosure are trying to figure out whether this latest blow-up is going to give them some more time. Some are still fighting to hang on to their houses, but others at this point have given up and are basically just living in their houses for free.
I don't need to live in this big a place. I can't afford it.
Shirley Sargent is sitting in the living room of her spacious two-story house in a recently built subdivision in southern Maine. She owes close to $300,000 on it, and she got the original loan from Countrywide.
I thought it was a good investment. I honestly did. I liked the neighborhood. I liked the proximity to the turnpike.
But then Sargent lost her job. She had worked in the mortgage industry, actually. Now she's 64 years old and working two retail jobs and making less money. For a while, she paid her mortgage and her own health insurance, but soon she'd wiped out her savings.
I must have gone through $30,000.
So back in 2008, Sargent gave up paying her mortgage, and she called up the mortgage company and told them that.
I said, I'll happily turn the keys over to you if that's what you want.
But even before this latest mortgage industry snafu, the gears of the foreclosure machine were turning very slowly, and the bank still has not taken back Sargent's house. At one point, Countrywide sent her a letter about having lost some of her documents, and even after Bank of America bought Countrywide,
they kind of forgot about me for a while, which was kind of nice because I got to stay for a couple of years, you know?
Yeah, I mean, so you've been here for 2 years and you haven't made a single mortgage payment, basically, right? I mean,
no.
Sargent said she did anything the lender asked her to do. She's maintained the property. She's tried to find a buyer for a short sale.
I've done everything that I possibly can to make the bank happy, except pay the bill.
That's kind of a
kind that of a really makes thing. Them happy.
Yeah.
Now, Sargent appears close to the end. She has a court hearing in a week that's likely to result in a foreclosure, but Bank of America has been halting foreclosures around the country. And so that could mean that people like Sargent get even more time to live in these homes for free.
It's not free. Somebody has to pay.
Anthony Sanders is a finance professor at George Mason University. He says foreclosures dragging on too long already cost the overall financial system billions of dollars. So he is completely against calls for a nationwide moratorium to stop all foreclosures. He says that would be very bad for the housing market and the economy.
Oh, yeah. And the longer this drags out, the worse it's going to get. The average time to foreclosure or liquidation of these assets is 17 months.
That is a long time, but housing advocates say that those are 17 highly dysfunctional months. John and Nancy Longvall are homeowners in Maine who have had their income cut back in the recession, but they still make enough money to pay their mortgage if it was at a reduced interest rate. And so they should qualify for what's called a loan modification. And for 2 years now, they've been trying to get one.
We'd send them the paperwork. I faxed everything that they asked for the next day. Someone else would call. They'd say, we need more paperwork.
Would send it in, and then they'd say, well, we lost that one.
Could not talk to the same person. Nobody knew who was doing what.
John Longvall is a former construction worker. He and his wife worked and saved their whole lives for this house, and they put 20% down when they bought it.
It's a dream home to us.
But now it turns out there's something new that's helping. The state of Maine has started a so-called mandatory mediation program that requires lenders to send a representative to meet with the homeowner and their lawyer or counselor and to try to work out a plan in person with a mediator. Chris LaRoche is the Longvall's housing counselor.
As a result of the Longvall's filing the response and requesting the mandatory mediation, City Mortgage responded within a couple of weeks with a permanent modification.
In other words, LaRoche says this mediation effort is working, and he's hopeful that all the attention on foreclosures right now will go beyond the legal paperwork questions and create momentum to get promising efforts like this one up and running in other states. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Now, despite the high-profile efforts of the president and the first lady, some Democratic candidates are complaining that their party is not doing enough for them. And at least one Republican, Delaware's Christine O'Donnell, a Senate candidate, thinks her party is not doing enough for her. Let's go now to the analyst who always does enough for us, NPR's Cokie Roberts. Cokie, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. I'm certainly glad to hear that.
Why are the candidates complaining?
Well, the Democrats are doing two things. Some Democrats are just saying that, you know, hey, that's not my party. Those liberals in Washington don't represent me. And they're separating themselves from Speaker Pelosi, from the president. The candidate for the Senate in West Virginia is shooting the cap and trade energy bill in an ad. But others are saying, hey, wait, where's the party when I need it? And the fact is the resources just aren't there to support every single candidate who's running, and the Democrats are pulling out resources from some candidates who they just don't think can win and putting their money into candidates that they think have a chance. Christine O'Donnell, the very controversial candidate for the Republican Senate seat in Delaware, the Republican candidate, who was yesterday called by Meghan McCain, Senator John McCain's daughter. Meghan said that her generation sees Christine O'Donnell is a nut job. O'Donnell said, feels that she's not getting support from her party. She probably has some basis for saying that. But after saying that in Washington and complaining about it on television, then she went back to Delaware and said, no, she's independent of her party, and she's running on that.
Well, let's remember here that in surveys, voters say that both parties are very unpopular. In fact, Democrats suggest that's one of their few bright spots, is that nobody seems to like Republicans. Everybody's saying they're independent from their parties. What does that mean, though, for the candidates who finally get elected and will be expected to govern in some way in January?
This is going to be fascinating to watch. You've got all these candidates who are saying that they're against Washington, against government. That's hardly unusual. But the difference this time around is that a lot of these people have never served in office before. They've never been in a position where they've tried to get something done in a legislative body. And they think compromise is a dirty word, so that the impulse to get anything done is going to be very small indeed. And to cross the aisle to get something done is going to be non-existent. Not only, Steve, for the people who are elected this time, but for the people who are up next time, because they've had the example now that even someone as conservative as Bob Bennett in Utah, the fact that he crossed the aisle to work with Democrats on some issues made him not pure enough ideologically, and so he was defeated in his primary. And of course, we can go down the list, ticking off all of the aisle crossers who have been defeated or are likely to be defeated. And that makes the people who remain in the Senate particularly unwilling to compromise with the other party. We had something pretty similar after the 1980 election. The difference there was that a lot of those candidates ran as Reagan supporters, so they actually had a program to back. These candidates are just running against, not for anything. But there's an object lesson here as well, which is that a lot of those Reagan candidates who were elected in 1980 were defeated in 1986.
Well, of course, whoever wins election to Congress in November will have to work with, or perhaps we should say work in the same city as, President Obama, who was expected to transcend a lot of these partisan differences, or seemed, his supporters seem to think so. And now he's given an interview to the New York Times Magazine, seeming to acknowledge that he's made some mistakes.
He says he's let himself look like the same old tax and spend Democrat. He's come to understand that he has to forge a consensus, not just bully ahead with what he thinks is right. Quote, success is determined by the intersection in policy and politics, and you can't be neglecting of marketing and PR and public opinion. So he seems to be saying he couldn't sell his programs, not that there's anything wrong with his programs, but I think that he seems amazed that he's considered Washington and that all of these people running against Washington are running against him.
Okay, thanks very much. As always, that's NPR's Cokie Roberts, who joins us for analysis each Monday morning. You hear her right here on Morning Edition from NPR News.